In mixed-race Superman, Keanu, Obama, and multiracial experience, author Will Harris offers an unusual comparison of actor and celebrity Keanu Reeves and former President Barack Obama and their real-life and professional heroics to explore the politics and cultural challenge of what it means to be mixed race. Folding in his own Indonesian British heritage into the conversation, Will Harris explores the resistance that can come with cultural formlessness and the challenge of occupying the cultural paradox of racial othering in a world that asks for constant identification. Will Harris and his new book, Mixed Race Superman, Keanu, Obama, and Multiracial Experience, today on The Keenest Observers. Will Harris is a London-based poet and critic. He is the author of the book of poems All This Is Implied and was awarded a poetry fellowship from the Arts Foundation in 2019. His work has appeared in The Guardian, The London Review of Books, The Poetry Review, and elsewhere. Will Harris, thank you for being here.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Most definitely. Most definitely. I want to start out with what I thought was an interesting beginning point in your press materials that said it might be, you know, odd to compare or set space to have a conversation on heroics and the multiracial experience offering Keanu Reeves and Obama as comparisons. How did you come up with that, and what is it to define a multi or a mixed race Superman?
I guess in answer to the first question, it was quite a kind of flippant idea. I'd been planning this kind of longer book about mixed race, multiracial archetypes, characters in fiction, film, TV, and also, you know, real life authors and actors. But I was asked for a shorter pitch for this book, and I kind of plucked these two out because they seemed, I guess, because they were different. But they were born at almost the same time. They're both American. They're both different kinds of mixes, and it just seemed like there would be like a useful difference in comparing them. And then the more I got into it, the more it seemed to make sense. In the book, I don't know if you want me to go into it now.
Sure. We can start at the beginning. We'll have a couple of segments to get into it. This is just the beginning, so I'm looking forward to delving in.
Okay. Well, so just broadly, I kind of quickly realized the reasons they appealed to me were completely opposite. So Keanu represents almost the spirit of diffuseness. You know, he's like impossible to pin down. Whereas Obama represents this kind of like this force of solidity. He's like slowly hardening lava or something. Every part of his life fits into this perfect narrative, I mean, which he himself consciously narrativized in Dreams from My Father. And so the more I thought about that, the more they became these kind of two poles to think about my own identity. This desire to both be diffuse, to be not pinned down, and also this desire to make sense of everything, which I think a lot of people who are between cultures feel.
Most definitely.
That's essentially why.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's essentially why I chose them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally does. I think that that's an interesting thing, an interesting fold in to kind of ground the structure of the book, which really does come back to you and how you kind of began your own search for identity, that, you know, that the idea of not really looking at race, you know, or being in between the identity that seems to be one way of looking at race and then being of mixed race is a paradox, as you called it. And so it was an interesting thing to start the book off with, folding Keanu into a heroic person for yourself, but then kind of making that juxtaposition. So yeah, most definitely. But I'd like to, you know, get in as we kind of continue, like to this idea about those two individuals as being formless heroes, and what you mean by that when you say that.
Well, I guess I think of Keanu as the formless hero.
Got it.
I think of Obama actually as the opposite, as the very consciously formed hero. Like a lot of politicians, you know, you begin your career with your memoir, with, you know, you setting out your story about exactly who you are. Whereas Keanu has almost made a career out of no one really knowing who he is. I think that's why there are all these memes around him, because there's this kind of mystery at the heart of him. And all the like crazy, all the crazy stories that circulated throughout his career about his private life and all of that. And also in films, he often plays, it's kind of interesting, you rarely meet his parents in a film. He always just seems to come from nowhere and is fully, fully formed.
Right, right. You have this quote.
He often plays characters called John.
Right. A bunch of characters called John, and he just pops out of nowhere. Whereas there's a part in the book that you quote from Dreams of My Father, and we'll get into this a little later, where Barack talks about a man not being able to be whole unless he unites all of the parts of himself. As we kind of get into it, we're going to talk about like that juxtaposition and what that meant for your own development. But can you start, you know, maybe briefly getting into the beginning of that?
For me, I don't want to generalize beyond my experience, but I think for a lot of people, like I said, who are kind of between cultures, so my mom's Indonesian, Chinese, my dad's English, I think there's often a pressure to assimilate, which I think everyone in a minority feels. England has a particularly pernicious kind of drive to assimilate, to integrate, which is often like less clearly stated maybe than in some other Western countries. But I definitely felt that growing up. I know my mom didn't pass on Indonesian to me. We didn't have many reminders of Indonesian culture. There was this sense that if I was going to succeed in England, I would have to be English. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a long time to try and navigate my identity, because I had this experience where I thought I was English.
I'm going to interrupt you really quickly because we're going to have to go to break.
Oh, sorry, we're going to.
And I want to pick up right there, because I think this is the downbeat of the book that allows you to go then to philosophy and practice and then come back to the heroes. Before the break, Will, you were talking about your upbringing in Great Britain and the challenge of being mixed race. Could you continue talking about that?
Mm. So I guess what I was saying is there was this pressure to assimilate. I went to a majority white Roman Catholic school. And then there was just this point when I was maybe 11 or 12 where people started kind of asking me where I was from, obviously a kind of pretty common experience. But for me, it was, I think, maybe for the mixed race, it was particularly confusing because I was just like, I'm English, I'm from London. And for a long time, I kind of tamped down that confusion about identity. I thought that I could see beyond it. I kind of imagined myself I didn't really think about my body, the way my body existed in the world. I thought that through kind of reading, through studying, I could kind of transcend my experience. And I guess part of the process of writing this book was thinking about that journey towards understanding how my body exists in the world.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting and really well-crafted part of the book. You start out kind of setting who you'd like to play you if you were in the movie, and that was Keanu. And you talked about Keanu's, perception or the quote that he even says about, you know, wanting to be everything and nothing, basically. But I believe what was really kind of poignant, you know, that you're speaking to was the second part of the book, which kind of lands right into your upbringing and what was happening in the UK during that time, which, you know, was some of the unrest during the Labour Party years. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's mainly when I grew up, 97 to 2010. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there was racial unrest and social unrest, you know, going on during that time that kind of forced, I think, people's hands to kind of wake up and see that there was some division from the UK. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah. No, I mean, there was a huge amount. I mean, it's something people don't talk about. I think I quote the statistic, but actually the black British prison population in proportion to the population as a whole in the UK is larger than in the US.
Right.
And if you look at any number of measures in terms of police brutality, underachievement at school, you know, exclusions. I mean, the Britain lags behind Europe, lags behind, you know, any number of places. And as I but when I grew up, you know, we had these, there were these stories occasionally, you know, in the 80s, obviously, I don't know if you know about it, over there, there were lots of riots, mm-hmm. especially in South London, in Brixton. There were a few famous, there were a few murders which became infamous, like police murders, gang murders. This kid called Stephen Lawrence was mm-hmm. murdered in the early mm-hmm. 90s. I don't know if that became a story in the U.S.
Yeah, maybe not. It did. It hit. Well, it hit in the urban areas, and I think, you know, I was, you know, in the Chicago area, in the Southern Illinois area, and we got it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was big because it because of what it exposed about, I guess, the about systemic racism within the police force and the way they dealt with the case. They just didn't take it seriously. They didn't believe that it was that it could have been a racist attack, racially motivated crime. And the killers were, you know, basically walked free for a number of years. But all this happened. But I often think the difference between maybe Britain and the U.S. is that these incidents were treated as individual incidents. Nobody ever made links between them. There was always this idea that Britain was a multicultural society, and that was the buzzword of the New Labour Blair years. You know, Britain's was just in love with this idea of it, of its tolerance. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the idea that was drummed into me when I was growing up. I lived in a multicultural, but it was a kind of confusing idea because what did it mean for me? You know, what does it mean to be multicultural? I didn't feel multicultural. Mm-hmm. I just felt, the effect was the pressure to be English or to not stick out, to not be different, to look different maybe, but not to do anything which makes you different, they sometimes called it like saris and samosas. It was all about food and dress, but it wasn't, you know, stuff that was kind of ornamental, that was on the surface, but didn't actually kind of, that wasn't challenging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that was the climate. Yeah, I think in hindsight, looking back, there's something I talk about in the book, that was the climate growing up, which didn't really encourage me to think about, to engage with my mum's identity, that side of my family, and meant that I had this kind of painful reckoning as I got older, as I became, where I did just realize I had no kind of stable sense of myself or who I was, because I hadn't been able to look at myself, I'd felt this kind of shame about myself, actually.
Yeah, I think that was what was incredibly interesting in that part of the book, that the self-concept that you received actually came from external observation of who you are. You said that I looked at myself as a white English person, but it was as you grew older and were perceived as an Asian person or Pan-Asian person that you were like, oh, wait a minute, I'm being perceived as other. Which I think is an interesting then jumping off to, like, you know, the beautiful idea of this of the parallel of these two mixed race supermen, if you will, and that is kind of brilliant construction and a brilliant idea for the book. I think, you know, a lot of us tend to, you know, whether or not we're mixed race or people of color, or, you know, dependent on the range, you know, you don't get it. Some people don't get a sense of what that means until someone else from that is external of our experience identifies us in quotes, right? And then your self-concept is kind of like, you know, shook up for a second until you find your legs. But you do a different, you do an interesting thing then, right? At that point in the book, you then go straight into some European philosophy, Western philosophers, and to ground Keanu and then Barack. Can you talk about, you know, how that came about and how you ground that in the book?
Well, yeah, I saw there are these different strands. I'm also talking about the idea of heroism, what it means and where it comes from. And that it's actually this very recent idea from the 19th century, from the writings of this guy called Thomas Carlyle, who was then read by Friedrich Nietzsche in a lot of detail. And Carlyle develops this kind of great man idea of history, which is very popular in Victorian society, that history is shaped not by wider social forces, but by individuals, single men, always men, who manage to bend history to their destiny. And Nietzsche takes that and develops into this idea of the Übermensch, someone who isn't dictated to by the herd, someone who knows themselves uniquely. And I guess what was interesting to me in that was also the way that that overlapped with the development of race science in the 19th century. You know, that's when race as a category really begins to mean something in its modern sense, you know, when race is being institutionalized and people are dividing up the world in terms of economic spoils, but also in terms of categories of who you are based on your, you know, based on your physical attributes.
Right.
And that there's also this idea of the individual, and those two kind of seem to coalesce.
I mean, that is the. I mean, we can't get away, and I think it's an interesting part of this conversation that, you know, you kind of speak to in kind of an implied way and explicitly about, you know, these constructions coming out of colonialism and coming out of the construction of race. And that's batted around whether or not, you know, race is a real thing or a human construct. You say in the book, to be mixed race is to exist in a state of paradox. Race is an illusion that depends on purity and singleness. The mixed race Superman is paradox made manifest, emptiness as form. Why do you say race is an illusion?
Race is an illusion. Well, I mean, it doesn't exist. there's no scientific basis for race. But as an idea, it's incredibly powerful because it fits with much older ideas to do with purity, to do with power, to do with domination. And in the 19th century, there was this idea of, and it's always taken different forms, to do with climate, to do with blood, to do with all these different ways of proving it. But they all essentially come down to proving kind of wholeness and purity, all these ideas which come to be really important for the hero as well, the idea of who a hero is, you know, the obsession with the blood, the lineage, the hero, the, you know, the family, the origin. And so the book is meant to be, even though it has this title, Mixed Race Superman, it's about paradox. It's about critiquing the hero, about actually thinking in terms of race, we need to move beyond, you know, if we're going to undermine race, we need to move beyond thinking of heroes, beyond thinking of individuals.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Andrew, did you thought?
No. If you had something.
Well, I think that's what I was going to ask. Is the second part of that quote, of that line, talks about where you're headed, which is, you know, the paradox that is what heroes in this form kind of like force on to people, and that you illuminate through these two men. But could you illuminate more? I think you're about to get to the second part of the question I was going to ask anyway.
Okay, well, I was going to mention, I talked about this book written in 1917 by this mixed-race Jamaican writer called J.A. Rogers, who lived in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
And he's loosely associated with the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes.
He wrote this book called, do you know him?
Yes, I know him and the book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, yeah, it's really amazing. He's an amazing independent scholar, you know, one of those incredible, everything he wrote was self-published, but published huge amounts. Yeah, called From Superman to Man.
Mm-hmm. J.A. Rogers.
And it's about this conversation between a railway porter and a racist state senator. And over the course of this journey, they have this long conversation over several days. And by the end of it, this railway porter has basically entirely changed this senator's mind, to the extent that they arrive in California and the senator says, I want you to come with me and make films so we can educate the world about the evils of racism. And this porter is this kind of, he's a heroic figure. He speaks several languages. He was educated at Yale. He fought in the war. He seemingly read all of anthropology, all of you know, current scientific thinking on race, on, you know, every part of the globe. And it takes that for him to be able to change the mind of this racist state senator. And it's this idea of excellence, which people of color grow up with, but which in so many ways is still embodied in people, in figures like Obama, and so expected from them. They have to be better than, they have to be, because there's an amazing kind of parallel to that in Dreams of My Father, where Obama recounts a story that was told to him about his dad, about a racist encounter in a bar in Hawaii, where a man says he doesn't want to drink liquor next to Barack Sr., Barack Obama's dad. Mm-hmm. And Barack, rather than getting angry, the whole bar falls silent. He spends 10 minutes explaining to him why he's wrong, talking about the universal rights of man, that kind of thing. And by the end, this man feels so bad, he gives him $100 and apologizes, and his mind has changed.
Right.
And this is the kind of, I guess, the idea I can see the appeal of, but I'm trying to kind of resist in this idea of mixed race Superman. I mean, that's, you know, the idea that you can, that just intellect alone can kind of conquer history, you know, because it's still using these same faulty tools, these same ideas inherited from the 19th century of the great man. And those ideas are tied up in purity and ideas of purity and wholeness and race, essentially, that we can't, that, you know, that will only get us so far.
Right, and there are these heroics tied to these men or people, and well, no, you, like you said in the book, it's mostly men, right? It's
yeah, exactly.
It's very single. It's not even binary. It's just single men, you know, and hetero men who become exemplars of these heroics, because the end part of that story and is, you know, and he bought rounds for the whole bar, you know what I mean? And so, because the feel good, you know, completion of the yeoman's work of this particular hero. And you kind of allude to that as well, as you step in to then, you know, looking at the parallels of these two mixed race men and the differences, right, between heroics, like one formless in Keanu Reeves, who, you know, is kind of like, from an identity point of view, you know, you don't know who he is, but he appeals to everyone, but also kind of moves into kind of like, not in a bumbling way. And I think that's an interesting thing too, is like this in different cultural sociology and stories, we have this, like, you know, unknowing hero as well, right, who just kind of walks through the space, you know, like Kane, you know, from Kung Fu, forgive the reference, and kind of walks through the world and kind of then bumps into these heroic situations in juxtaposition with Barack Obama, who is this very, from the jump, you talk about, you know, his people saying that he was like a very well-formed young man who we knew, you know, with chest poked out and ready to fly to some degree. And so I'd like to talk about more about that. We're talking to Will Harris, author of Mixed Race Superman, Keanu, Obama, and Multicultural Experience. Give us a ring at 800-838-3760 if you would like to come on in with the conversation. But like, yeah, I would love to kind of talk about that then. Like, you know, then, you know, like you talk about these heroics, you know, that are more than just intellectual on one side, and in terms of the adjustment of what it is to kind of, you know, make the parody of being able to just be human in the world. But then on the other side, there's this, you know, like Keanu is Neo, right? You know, he is the one. So, you know, how does that happen? What's the bridge, you know?
Yeah. How does he become the one? Why? I mean, I think he's the only person who could have pulled that off. I mean, because he isn't the one. I mean, it's like, I guess it's like he's the many in one. he's not really the one in like a, you know, he's not a hero in the kind of conventional way. You know, he's like this anomaly in the Matrix, right? He's something that doesn't fit. And again, in that role, he kind of still kind of comes from nowhere. He's this like oddball, this stuttering like hacker who lives by himself, and he's not. I think it would have been so wrong if he'd been like a white all-American guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he has to be a kind of outsider, someone, and that's another thing you touched on, masculinity, the way that ties into the Superman and idea. And Keanu isn't a masculine hero, really. Like, that's something that people have always talked about with him, femininity, and then that's why early in his career he was like endlessly asked about his sexuality, and he often refused to answer that question, which I think is really Great.
Well, you were talking about the fact that, you know, Keanu got some flack earlier in his career about his sexuality and the fact that he had to be an oddball to be the one, and how that really connects to, you know, your thesis about the mixed race Superman.
Yeah, but he refused to be pinned down. He refused to answer it. He refused to, he refused to accept what the poet Adrian Rich calls, you know, the compulsory bias of heterosexuality. For him, there's a kind of power in resisting definitions, in being fluid. And that's what makes him, I think that is what defines, even though he's called, you know, even though he's Neo, even though he's the one, he isn't the one. He's this kind of fluid, he's this very weird, unique kind of fluid hero. That's why I think it's interesting to juxtapose him to Agent Smith, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that's why I think if he was a white, I don't know who else could have played Neo, but if they picked a kind of white action star, it just wouldn't, that contrast wouldn't have worked. You know, Agent Smith has this visceral disgust of Neo, of Morpheus, of the resistance, and Agent Smith represents this kind of white patriarchal order. And there's the amazing moment in the first Matrix film where Neo, to defeat him, ends up having to penetrate him, to go inside of his chest, and he bursts, and then he explodes him into 1,000 splinters, of, you know, into 1,000 pieces. And that feels so symbolic of what Neo, what Keanu represents, or to me at least.
Yeah, totally.
This kind of wind, this that breaks things apart. Actually, his name, I think, translates to like a cool breeze through the mountains.
Right.
That he's this kind of wind blowing apart certainty.
Right. Cool breeze over the mountains, Keanu.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think then, you know, as that kind of juxtaposition, kind of, it's an interesting juxtaposition. You said it like it pulls a lot of potential threads. Like on one side, Keanu through characters, right, that he's definitely played, and his literal life in Celebrity, who, you know, is like, you know, what is the quote that you state in the book about, you know, I'm like Mickey Mouse, no one knows who's inside. And then the return is like, you know, well, it's Mickey. And then he says something to the effect like, well, yeah, him too, or something like that. But the fact that, you know, even as personality and within the roles that he's played, he actually sets a real social criticism that is, okay, if we're going to move in a particular direction, here are these people that are standing in wait or like just in present that are like, you know, I think it's interesting. Our show is called The Keenest Observers for a reason, right? There are all these people that are here and are paying attention and are aware of this very, on the other side, like, you know, representation of the juxtaposition that could be like, you know, Barack Obama, who is a very formed, you know, person in a very formed system. And so how the information crosses between these two places and these two orientations is the space that we have to navigate to move forward, not only as individuals, but like literally collectively. And you kind of use that as the kind of, I mean, that's literally the end part of your book. I just kind of put it in my words, but you kind of speak to that conceptually. Would that be accurate kind of to say?
Yeah.
Or no? Mm.
No, that's a really great summary of what I'm trying to do. and also trying to kind of hold these two different ideas in without having to kind of choose between them.
Right.
You know, there's this idea that we've got to choose. You've got to choose a path. I'm going to not be racialized. I'm going to reject all definition, or I'm going to form myself into this heroic, better than person. But it's about understand to me that what I was trying to do was hold both of them, both the successes and pitfalls of both paths in mind at the same time.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. No. I mean, to me, like the experience of racialization is this kind of series of traps about, you know, where you can be stereotyped, pigeonholed, reduced at every turn. We're expected, you know, different kinds of expectation to be, you know, to be exceptional or to be just one of, you know, a certain kind, a type. So that's quite broad.
No, most definitely. I think that, you know, you've got to get to the broad to get to the specific subtitles. But I think that's interesting. In the book, you end up talking about how even Nietzsche says that, you know, history doesn't have to be the story of brightly lit individuals, active and masculine, mm-hmm. doing great deeds. Our stories don't have to be about achieving self-knowledge or failing to do so. You go on to say that they could be about the spaces between. So,
yeah,
what does that mean? What does that mean to you? And what are the examples of kind of those spaces between?
Yeah, well, that's the nub of the book. That's the kind of right. point of it to me. Yeah, it's this journey to, I guess, so there's this thread running through it of various people who say, know thyself, know mm-hmm. who you are. Mm-hmm. There's this the famous taxonomist Linnaeus, who taxonomized everything, created the kind of Latin category system next to human. He just put know thyself, mm-hmm. because he thought that humans were defined by rationality. They just need to know who they were. And there's this idea in a lot of writing, a lot of culture, that's you know, like a Socrates, you know, you know, that's like an inherently good thing. But then it has this dark side. There's this you know, famous racial scientist, Harvard educated Ku Klux Klan guy, Lothrop Stoddard. He ended his book, The Race Realities of Europe, by saying, know yourself. You know, what does it mean to know yourself, basically? That was what I kind of, that actually maybe knowing yourself isn't what we need. You know, maybe we need to unknow ourselves. Hmm. Maybe we need to, you know, and that's what it means, existing in the spaces between, that's often the spaces that, what I felt, had been denied to me, as a person of color, that I always had to know myself. And either I didn't know myself or I did, but actually it can be something more complex than that. You know, allowing for that complexity. I think white people are often allowed to not know themselves, you know, to be lots of different things. And it's about kind of, you know, to reclaim that space. And that is actually something that I take from, you know, Nietzsche wrote a lot of problematic stuff. mm-hmm. Or stuff he wrote in this kind of high prophetic form, so a lot of it can be interpreted in lots of different ways, but he said he did have an unconquerable mistrust of the possibility of self-knowledge.
Right.
And he said the most certain thing he could know about himself was this aversion in me to believing anything definite about myself.
Right.
And that's something powerful to me. And like, that kind of chimed with this thing that Audre Lorde wrote, where she said, when I speak of knowledge, as you know, I'm speaking of that dark and true depth which understanding serves, waits upon, and makes accessible through language to ourselves and others. It's the depth within each of us that nurtures vision. And I think it's that, yeah, that dark and true depth, which is where vision comes from, mm-hmm. which is a space in between, which isn't a space of self-knowledge, I think. It's actually a space of self-doubt, of confusion, even.
Yeah. Actually, yep. the ether of unknowing, right? You know, that's where that's how you come to find it and shape it, you know, and get some like understanding and having the next piece of information to then maybe lead you to the next space that is, right? That you know, another time to be able to do the same operation again and again and again. Hopefully, if you're evolving, I would suggest that that's the case. I think that's an interesting, you know, point that you made in terms of what might be the difference between folk. You know, of mixed race and of color, or just or people who also feel like they have to run in mainstream to be able or orient themselves in a mainstream way in order to navigate. And I think that's an interesting point that you make in the book in terms of Barak's construction, in terms of his development and construction, that he put all of these pieces, and in fact, kind of knew, you know, interestingly, all of these pieces that he needed to kind of put together in order to be whole. So it feels like, you know, given your point, you know, that you just made in terms of the spaces, you know, of you know, that don't have knowledge, that maybe he was very aware, you know, of the knowledge pieces. And I would be very interested to wonder, and I bet he does, like, what those spaces of unknowing are for him. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be really interested. I mean, obviously, once he became a politician, that kind of the space for unknowing kind of closes up pretty quickly.
Most definitely is publicly, for sure.
publicly. Yeah, I'm interested in the next few, you know, to see what, I guess, his book he's working on, if he does kind of open up more. I mean, he's remained pretty quiet in the last couple of years. But yeah, he has an amazing critical mind. It's like it's there in Dreams of My Father. But I wonder how he reflects on his legacy now.
So let me ask you this, given this juxtaposition, I know I think we, you know, we talked about the summary that I made, and the summary that you make, you know, of the book is in, you know, really well written in the last four pages or so of the book. But if you gave this book to someone, especially as, you know, as poet critic, if you gave this to someone maybe who was just kind of getting their own first piece of this, you know, What would be the first few lines you would say to them even before you gave them the book, if they were from, you know, maybe even your mixed culture or someone else or another mixed culture, I should say?
What would I say to them to kind of introduce them to the book?
Maybe the primer to the book to introduce them.
That's the tough one. I mean, I would probably say read the book.
Right. totally. Yeah. I totally understand why you would say that.
I would have. I guess what I try and do in the book and the way I structure it, it's in these kind of mini sections. Point of it is to try and think, to try and bring about a different kind of thinking, which is more open and fluid and scattered. And I would say, I hope this challenge, you know, this challenges some ideas you have about, you know, being a man, being what it means to be, you know, a person, identity, what it means to know yourself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Maybe.
I think that there would be a great beginning. And actually, I guess that was sort of an unfair question because you kind of do it in the first, you know, few pages. You actually give the beginning comments that I could expect to hear. In the last minute that we have, how does this book compare or parallel to your poetry? I guess I did. From the outset, we said, you know, that you're a poet and critic. How does this parallel, or does it?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of different in that it has an argument and it has quotes. But I try to structure it in a similar way. So poetry often works on kind of motifs, you know, images, phrases which come up again and again. And like I said, with this, I was also thinking about certain images, the idea of masks, of self-knowing, and structuring it less in a kind of linear A to B way and more in terms of those motifs. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked that about poetry because I think it's generative. It gives kind of more power to the reader. Like when I read a poem, I'm being given something to make myself. I'm not just being told, you know, have this. And that's what I hope the book is as well. It's something that I'm giving you these kind of pieces, which I have an idea of what they add up to, but I hope that the reader will make something else from them. And I think that's a kind of poetic approach, maybe.
Yeah, totally. Totally. That totally makes sense. What do you feel, is there a poem that you've written that parallels this book at all that comes to mind?
I've written a lot about identity. I've got a book coming out next year called Rendang, which is the kind of poetic equivalent to this.
Beautiful, beautiful. Hey, Will Harris, thanks for being here with us. Thank you, and many, many thanks. That's it for today.
Yeah,
most definitely. I appreciate the conversation and the book.